Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Here we are again. Russ and I were talking about choices, driving in from Ottawa, and options. As a culture, we have tremendous opportunities and choices and options. And I was reflecting on one aspect of consciousness which we usually don't choose to notice, and that's the aspect of consciousness which isn't engaged with the objective world, which isn't engaged with sights or sounds or tastes or thoughts or emotions or memories. And that's what I was trying to indicate by contemplating a receptive way of being, where you're just listening, where you're just waiting, but waiting for nothing. And if you think about the way we make choices, we tend like if we're making choices and like in consumerism, encouraging us to follow all those options which will make us happy. And so the consumer ethic is pleasure. That if you make the correct choices that will maximize your pleasure. Whether it does or not is another question. But so the mind is always engaged with assessing which object should I choose, which sound, which sight, which person, which experience, which will give me more pleasure and less pain. And that's one way we choose. That way you're engaged with objects, with ideas. With possibilities, so whether I want to choose to buy a new car, I have to engage with looking at the ads, and then I have to engage my mind with can I afford it, can I not, and all the costs. So my attention is engaged with certain objects of mind. If I'm making choices based on altruism, caring for my mom, or doing good works in the world, the choices are, how am I going to optimize my mom's health? How can I make choices which will make sure she'll have less pain? What do we need to do to make sure she's comfortable with her arthritis? So again, it's altruism, it's good, but the mind is always out. It's engaged with problem solving and so on. Scientific inquiry, I might be interested in the difference between black squirrels and brown squirrels, and then I set up an experiment to watch and witness, or I might be interested in bird life, so my mind is engaged with ideas, with forms, with color, with sound. So there, most of our life does. That's normal, isn't it? That's normal to be engaged, to make choices. Depending on what we're doing, my responsibilities, I have certain responsibilities I have to fulfill, so I make choices based on my moral precepts, based on a certain ethic that a community runs by, and so I'm considering, okay, what's the ethically correct thing to do now, and what would be most appropriate for communal harmony, and that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but again, my mind is engaged with making choices. One kind of low-level way of engagement that our culture has is like all the media that people have. So a person might just veg out in front of the television. They had a really stressed day and they just kind of look at something. It doesn't really matter what it is anymore, as long as the mind's just marginally engaged on a low-level way of just kind of dulling out, I suppose. Or it might be very exciting. People actually watch horror movies and things like that. they excite the mind, but both are still an engagement. People get around with things in their ears, walking around with MP3s zipping through their head, so the mind is being engaged. Maybe they only hear the song for 10% of the time. Most of the engagement is through thought, thinking, analyzing, figuring out, remembering, complaining, hoping, expecting. So the attention is engaged with thought, because thought is an object of consciousness too. It's something that can be known. So there's many ways that we do that. Some are skillful, some are unskillful. The pursuit of pleasure is a pretty limited kind of way to live your life, and I think most of us have seen that there is a profit in giving up short-term pleasure for long-term happiness, true happiness, deep happiness, fulfillment. So that's the mature way of looking at pleasure. Oh, this will give me pleasure right now, but if I forego that pleasure and I take this more arduous route, I know there's going to be something more profound at the end of it. That's where you grow up, I suppose. But still, the mind is in engaged in that way. And this other way of kind of considering a way of consciousness where we're not engaging with thought, where we're not engaging with an idea, we're not engaging with some media form, some sound or a taste or an image of some sort, and we allow the mind to rest in waiting, to rest in receptivity. That's a kind of foreign territory, I think, for most of us. I think we touch it at times when it's sort of unbidden, when we're in some very relaxed situation, there's no pressure. I think one of the ways to look at this way of being, experimenting with that, is if you just imagine yourself in, let's say you're in Ottawa Airport, and you've gotten through security, and your luggage is on, the plane is on time, and you're sitting in one of those spacious lounges, and you got nothing to do. There's nothing to do, and you're just watching. It's kind of just anthropomorphizing, watching people. And it's quite relaxing. Nothing to do, nothing to do, plane's on time. It's okay, just watching. And that's the kind of attitude that I think is very useful in meditation, where rather than always just like trying to get somewhere in meditation or trying to achieve something, you adopt an attitude like you're in that airport. If you don't like airports, it won't work. But if you get the kind of principle of it, where you're not looking for something, but you're allowing life to come to you, life's experience to come to you. Another kind of image that I know Ajahn Sumedho likes to use a lot is the image of space and form, where when you think about form, then the forms in this room are people, colors, wood frames, sound is a kind of a form, audio form, and those are the things that attract our attention. So I look at the quality of the carpet, or I look at the color of the wallpaper, or I see who's here, who do I know. I listen to the sound of the furnace, is the furnace working well, and so on and so forth. The food comes on, I smell the food, it's nice, it'll be nice, and da-da-da. And that's form. The thought's also form. But to actually say, notice the space of the room, what do you have to do to notice the space? And you have to take attention away from a particular person or color or sound and just allow yourself to notice space. It's a bit more subtle. You can do it. You can kind of like, I know there's people in here, I know there's sound, but I let all that go to the background, and in the foreground I just kind of notice space. So I can't focus on anything. I have to just allow space. And that's a sort of analogy to the mind too, because the mind has both form and space, forms of thoughts and emotion and sights and sounds and such like, and then there's that ineffable space. If we make a kind of a move where we're not engaging with forms, what does that do? For me, it relaxes my mind. Now, if I hear an explosion in the kitchen, then that alerts my mind. I have to go and do something about it, which is fine. But to actually learn how to relax the mind, it seems to me a very good exercise is not engaging with forms and structures, and especially with thought. And that's hard, because thought, it rather engages us almost. It's like, you know, you get kidnapped by a worry, or a fantasy, or just the habit of replaying something or rehearsing something. So our attention is then preoccupied with the structures of thought. And these are objects of consciousness. But that knowing or that awareness is not really an object, it just is. So to train in that way, what would that do for you? You know, what kind of result would that have? Well, the thing about forms is the forms tend to be, you know, they're kind of attractive or repellent. You're interested in something or you don't like it. You're fascinated by something or you wish it wasn't here. So the forms of consciousness are they're restless things, because they're always being influenced by other factors. They can't really stabilize your mind. Why we choose the breath? Because that the breath is still a form, right? It's still a form. It's coming and going. But if you can pay attention to it in this kind of receptive way, your interest isn't so much in the form, but in that sense of receptive awareness, being with an in-breath, being an out-breath. That's what's important. It's not the breath that's so important. It's the very way of being with the breath. So you take, in meditation, we take something rather neutral or bland or whatever, and the breath usually, unless you're, you know, an asthmatic or something extreme, you just with something in a particular way, and it's the training of the mind being with something in this non-grasping way, in this way where you don't need anything from it, you're not expecting anything from it, you're just with it for the sake of being with it. And so that brings you to ideas like non-grasping, non-becoming, non-aversion, non-desire. We use the nons a lot in what we talk about. And what happens when the mind abides in non-greed, or non-aversion, or non-becoming, or non-trying to figure it out, or sort it out, or fix it, or whatever. What happens when the mind does that? Well, as soon as the mind comes to that kind of conclusion of not going anywhere, there immediately is a sense of peace. It might not last long, but there's a sense of peace because you're not trying to do anything anymore. You're not trying to fix, get rid of, become. There's a sense of composure. But sustaining that is rather hard, because the mind has habits of always looking for something. So you imagine if I've been working in front of a computer screen, and I'm analyzing problems, or I'm writing a text, and I'm trying to figure out how to get the sentences right, then my mind's always engaged in that way. It sees something and engages, try to fix it, make it right. So if I've done that for 5 hours in the day, then the way I observe consciousness itself would probably have those same kind of factors. Try to fix it, try to figure it out, try to do something about it, analyze it. And that would be a habit of mind which I would have to try to see as an object. And that habit of mind would be a kind of restlessness. If I can just be with the breath and then see how restless the mind is trying to get somewhere, do something, and I see that as an object, I see that very restless energy as an object, I begin to practice one of the factors which make the mind very, very calm: awareness of restlessness, awareness of this kind of becoming energy. That takes a lot of patience. But it's not going anywhere. It's not trying to get anywhere. It's just being in the moment, being in the moment. That's why meditation takes so much patience, because the habits of mind can be so annoying and irritating and persistent in the mind, and so you get ideas in meditation of both. You get ideas of attainment; those kinds of ideas exist. But also, you get the idea of like just like waiting, but waiting for nothing. That's a very simple idea. But if you can take that listening consciousness, just listen, just wait. You notice how difficult it is just to stay here, not do something. The mind will quickly start to figure out or try to do or whatever, or you fall asleep and wander off. So to actually, first of all, establish some sense of like open attention, free, like I like to think of it as free attention, where it's not, the mind isn't engaged, and then to train in that, because that is really the place of peace and consciousness. No object in itself is peaceful, because an object is always changing, but it's just something behind all the objects, that sense of receptive awareness, which is very, very peaceful. And that's where the spiritual life lies. It doesn't lie in me getting an object or doing something, but it lies in the sense of this moment is okay the way it is. It's moving. It's objects are moving, but this sense of awareness is okay as it is. So if you get back to the idea of choices, like to actually make the choice to not like always have to fix or become or whatever, is kind of foreign to our culture. It's always like productivity. I find like I have some spare time with mom. It's a funny kind of business taking care of an elderly person, because there's a lot of time but there isn't time. So I can see in my mind, oh, I should be productive. I should do something. I should write a book, or it just gets restlessness. That's what this idea of kind of Protestant productivity feels like. Because this, well, it's restless. And if I know that as an object, I don't write a book. But it's all right. It's just restlessness, just waiting. And so coming back to this sense of peace we have in us, it's always there, but it's so hidden by the choices we make to go outside, to be drawn into thought. You think about thought. Thought is like an object that draws you. Let's say I'm meditating, and I get a really fascinating idea of something I want to create. Then that's really attractive. It's an attractive idea to create something. And then if I make it that way, and then if I add one of those, and then if I make it blue, and the mind is kind of being entertained through some kind of seemingly creative energy. And then after a while, of course, that energy becomes annoying. And so after 10 minutes of that, oh, shut up, be quiet. And then we try to get rid of that object of thought. So we've conditioned into a mind certain all momentum around something which is, we think, is going to be lovely to make or create. And then that has its life. And then we start to not like it. And then we try to get rid of it. Yeah? And then we've fought in the struggle until we pick up another one. And so the mind is always engaged in this kind of struggle or restlessness of mind. Not that that's immoral. There's nothing wrong with that. But to make a choice to not engage in this way, to see things as movement, what that requires is the capacity to know the energy of mind which wants to go into objects. And that, in the Pali, we call tanha, or craving. And craving is a particularly kind of, or the word tanha is a it's a kind of technical term. It's sometimes translated as desire, but there are desires in consciousness which are very useful and skillful. My desire not to hurt others, my desire to understand consciousness, my desire to be a good person. Those are obviously wholesome and good desires. But there's also just that energy in the mind which always needs to go out into something else. And one of the very useful analogies of this is the one I've found very useful for many years, is the analogy of skin disease. And if you've ever been to a third world country, my experience in, say, in India, with dogs with mange, when a dog has mange, it just scratches itself until it's raw, because the itching is so strong. And so the analogy of the skin disease is that when you have a skin disease, like you have some kind of psoriasis, or say poison ivy is a good example. Poison ivy, if you get that stuff, it itches, right? And so what do? You you look for a way out of the itching sensation. You have craving. You have the craving to be free from the itching. So when you don't understand poison ivy, then what you scratch. So that gives you pleasure. And if you've ever had like poison ivy or a rash, or when you scratch it, it is very pleasant. Very, very pleasant. I've had lots of poison ivy. So there's no denying the pleasure in it. You know? Oh gosh, I feel so good. But then, if you've got this rash now. Now it's spread twice as much, three times as much, and you still have the itching. But now you have even more itching. So you take hydrocortisone, you put on Camomile, whatever. But it's still, you've got this itching. So at some point, you have to make a trade-off where you're going to forego the pleasure of short-term gratification by scratching. You're going to have to forego that, give that up, for the long-term cure, for the end of the disease. Otherwise, you're just going to be itching and scratching. And that applies to all kinds of areas of our life. If you take something like worry, you know how worry works? You have some possibility of future failure, say. Future sickness, I might get this, I might get that. The event might not come off, it might whatever. And although you plan to the nth degree, you might plan to the nth degree, lo and behold, because the future is unknown, when that discomfort comes up of what if this happens, that's like the itching. So what if that happens? What if this happens? And so a person has, you can see how some people will plan very well, but then they'll go further and they'll worry. What if this happens? What if that happens? That's the itching. And then what is the scratching? The scratching is thinking. So they think and think, well, if that happens, I'll do this, and then I'll do that, and then I'll do this, and then I'll do that. And then you get a solution. And that's just like, oh, gosh, that was good. But you scratch it for a while, and how, you know, what is it, a minute before you get the next doubt? And doubt comes out. Yeah, but if. And it's, you can just run with that for like, I don't know, long. And so now I'm scratching myself. So at some point you begin, you know, if you're contemplating the mind, you think, wow, okay, so itching and scratching, yeah. So what do I have to do? What is the itching that I have to bear with if I'm going to really cure my mind of this habit of worry? And you can see that what will happen is what if will come up, and your whole itching pattern will be to think. And then you have to be skillful enough to say, ah, this is what it feels like not to know. This is the itching of wanting to know. And you have to bear witness to that. And that takes forbearance, because just like the skin disease, you have to not scratch it. You just have to not, no, don't do it. And it's the same with a lot of the mental habits we have. That itching and scratching syndrome is so quick and so fast that we don't even know we are sometimes doing it. It just seems like reality until maybe someone tells us. So that's the way, one of the ways we talk about how our attention gets engaged in objects. Right? So part of the like learning to say meditate on an object of meditation, but seeing it's not the object, it's this way of receptive awareness or a clarity and clear comprehension, and learning how to be as that, like for half an hour, then what you tend to see is the pulling of attention into thought, the pulling of attention into visual objects or whatever, and you begin to have more skill in the choices you make. So maybe you learn how to meditate, you learn how to just be with the restlessness of the body, with the slight discomforts in the hips and the knees and so on. You just learn to just be with that. And you see the pull of like discomfort. You want to scratch that and move, but you say, no, I'll look at that itching. And you can sit through it, and your mind is quite peaceful because you haven't scratched it. And that gives you a kind of basic lesson of the more difficult things that the mind gets pulled to. And you find that you begin to have like this home base. You know, this kind of place of settled refuge that you can remember, you can reflect on by just saying things, this is the way it is now, or receptive awareness, or listening, just coming to listening. You find that kind of home base, and then you see the pulls. Now, you still have to respond to life. You still have to do what you have to do, but you start to make better choices. You make choices, well, you may be like, you're just restless and just like to go to the fridge all the time because you're restless or bored or lonely, and you've had your meal or whatever, and then you, because you've meditated, you see that pull to eat something, and you feel that pull. Oh yeah, that's itching, and you don't go there, and your mind comes home again, comes home into the settledness of peace. Now that's different than just trying to discipline yourself so you never eat too much. That's a way where you kind of maybe enforce a discipline on your mind, but soon enough, pretty soon you jump out of it. This way you're really noticing like the pull of things, and you're noticing the itching of that, and you're making a choice, well, what if I don't scratch that? Not as a kind of imperative, that you have to do something, but as a kind of choice of wisdom, a choice of skill, and then you see, well, what if I don't go there? What does it feel like? And that's, those choices then are choices which lead back home, back to your home base, back to that more pure kind of consciousness, which isn't dependent on sights and sounds and so on. And you can see the opposite. If every time there's a pull and one just reacts to that pull, then it's like just a mess. It's just a massive skin disease. itching, scratching. That's just going on all the time. And some, like our culture, does this very well. Itching, scratching, low-level TV watching kind of thing, and where the mind is just being slightly, stimulated by things, but the mind is still out. It's still out there, and then you don't. Then we don't realize the peace of the mind, the peace of the heart. And these are the kinds of things that they wouldn't like. You don't sell products with this kind of, It's not meant for consumerism. And the peace of the heart isn't something you consume. It's more like what you are. The peace of the environment is something I consume. Right? I come here and I drink that in. I love it. I mean, it's good for me. So not that these things can't be helpful, and nurturing. That's all very well and good. But what is it that doesn't consume? That knows, right? What is that home base which doesn't need objects? So to find a kind of healthy balance, we can use the world of sense experience in a way which creates a foundation for peace, rather than the world of things and objects being something that is just forever pleasure seeking. Because pleasure is a very, very kind of shallow kind of thing. So that we can enjoy pleasure. I can enjoy the pleasure of going out to the pond, looking at the space and the sky and hearing that. That's very pleasurable for the mind. I can use that as a basis for bringing my mind into silence. But if I'm just dependent on that, then what do I do when I go back to Ottawa? Or I'm in a busy situation, then it's an attachment, and then I resent going to Ottawa and I wish I was here, and then the mind is just caught up in objects. So without rejecting the beauty of life or the objective world, say, what are the choices I make? Do they lead to more itching and scratching? Or can I make choices which bring me home again and again and again to the peace of the mind, to the silence of the mind? And this, I think, is how you can think about spirituality as opposed to just trying to sort of be happy in a changing world, because this like spirituality is about something which is inherent in your consciousness, which is there all the time, but which gets hidden by the mind, which is always going out all the time. All right, something to consider.
Andvayam gamakataya sadhu karam gadamase. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.